so please feel free to make yourself comfortable and to stop me at any point with no guarantee of success, but you can feel free to try. So I was feeling to speak a little bit today about a specific part in the story of the Buddha's journey towards awakening, and to hopefully connect that to what we're doing here. So I'll give it my best shot and we'll see if it works. And we were speaking today, the four of us, about the beauty of the simple, basic teachings. And I find for myself somehow, over the years, kind of finding much, like more and more, that I love these stories of the Buddha's life and what they have to offer to me. So that's where this kind of sharing is coming from. So the story of the Buddha's life is quite a myth. It's quite like a legend. And the part that I want to speak about today is really the way he was raised. And so the story goes that his father was very concerned for his well-being. And he was concerned for his well-being in the way that he wanted him to grow up. His father was a king, and he wanted his son, the prince, to also grow up and be a king. That was his concern. And so he brought him up in the best way that he could imagine. He had every kind of comfort and physical pleasure that we could imagine. And he was kept away as much as possible from any kind of discomfort or distress or disease, anything that would be difficult to work with, to see. And so when it's spoken about in the stories, in the text, it's like this life of, you know, good food, comfortable beds, the best musicians, the best dancers, a beautiful wife at just kind of the right age when that becomes very interesting, and everything that anyone could want whose interest is to become, to go from being a prince to being a king. And what I find really interesting about this story is that despite having all of this, despite having every wish, every material wish fulfilled, despite having any kind of interest fulfilled, even sometimes before he could voice it, there was some kind of inherent curiosity or sense of interest in the Buddha that wasn't fulfilled by all of this. There was still something kind of looking, we can say, if we imagine his life growing in a palace, there was a part of him looking beyond the palace walls, wanting to know what else is out there. What else is out there? And I feel that that same sense of curiosity is something that we all have. It's kind of what brought us here, whether we articulated it that way or not. Some sense of interest, of wanting to go beyond the known parts of our lives into something else, to discover, to experiment, to explore something else. And so in the Buddha's case, because he was a prince and because his father was a king, and there was a lot of control over his life, he kind of went out on three kind of secret missions into the world. Him and in a chariot with his charioteer, the guy who drove the chariot. So they went out together three times, beyond the walls of the palace, outside the palace, and into the world. And on each of these trips out, so he went out three times, on each of these three trips, he encountered something that the story says he had never seen before. Something new. Something he had never seen before. Something he'd never met. So on one trip, he saw an old person. On another trip, he saw a sick person. And on the third trip, he saw a dead body. So we can say in these three trips outside of the palace walls, he met old age, sickness, and death. And in the traditional telling of the story, every time, it's really emphasized that this was completely new to him. So every time he asks his charioteer, "What is that? You know, what is that?" And the charioteer says, "Oh, that's an old person. You know, you too will one day become old. You know, this happens to all of us." And he sees a sick person and he says to his charioteer, "What is that?" He says, "Oh, that's someone who's sick, who's ill. You know, you've never been sick before. You know, if you haven't, then probably it will also happen to you." And then he sees a dead body and he's like, "What is that?" "Well, that's someone who's died. And that's going to happen to all of us." So every time there's this dialogue. And so if we look beyond kind of just the story aspect of the story and kind of what is it actually telling us about our own experience, we can imagine that even in the most controlled environment, a human being would have encountered aging, would have encountered sickness, would have encountered death. I mean, in the Buddha's experience, actually, his own mother died when he was very young. So this is not about really, you know, this kind of mythic thing of I've never heard of someone dying before, or I've never seen the changes in my own body before, or I've never felt unwell. You know, I've never had a headache or a cold. But it's actually about the difference between ignoring these aspects of life and actually really looking at them, really opening our eyes. And so when I think of this part in the story, I feel it's the awakening of the Buddha's interest in awakening. Seeing something that really, there was already the curiosity there, and then seeing things that made the curiosity really acute, really strong, really kind of unignorable, something that I need to attend to, that I need to pay attention to. And so also for all of us, we have these meetings. Sometimes we're not aware of them. Something that happens when we see something and we can't react to it in the same way, in the habituated way that we have before. It's calling our attention, and we need to respond. The times in our lives when we face what is there, the impermanence that Nathan was speaking about yesterday, the fact that everything changes, the fact that everything, including ourselves and our loved ones, will die. The times when that really comes close, or when we're able to open our eyes and look. Sometimes it feels like these are kind of secrets in our society that everyone knows, but no one talks about or no one relates to. If we think of what happens in the West when someone gets old, or when someone is sick, very sick, or dying. And in the story, these three meetings, the meetings with old age, sickness, and death, they're referred to as divine messengers. Old age or aging, sickness and death are referred to as divine or heavenly messengers. Messengers that are from beyond, beyond our everyday experience. And I find all the imagery of the story really, really helpful. So I'm going to kind of just stay with it for a little bit. The image of the palace, which is the way we protect ourselves from meeting life or meeting what we don't want to meet in life. The way, the image of the palace as the image of the way we turn away from the reality of life, which means equally that we're turning away from the potential for freedom. It comes together. It's like the way that image of the ostrich that buries its head in the sand when it's in danger. I don't actually know if that's true. I'm not. It'd be interesting to find out if it's just an urban myth or actually true of ostriches. But that image, anyway, that we all know and familiar with, whether it's true or not. That when we feel threatened or when we feel overwhelmed or when we feel this is something I don't want to deal with, we often just put our head in the sand or shut our eyes or stay in the palace, which is where I feel comfortable and safe. And it's also interesting that we use the same techniques today as were used in the Buddha's time 2,600 years ago to do that. Yeah. So we concentrate on being comfortable physically. And we find distractions. We have more to choose from nowadays, probably. But again, you know, the best entertainment, whether it's books or films or music or dance, whatever, theater, whatever we like. And I'm saying this not to say that any of these things is bad in itself. It's not. You know, this is a very beautiful, alive, creative part of life. But we just need to be aware of how we use those. When we use when we use things that we enjoy as a way to distance ourselves, as a barrier, as a palace wall, to keep ourselves away from experience or from what we don't want to see or feel. And so in that way, we're actually making the palace into a prison also. We're shutting ourselves off. I just have to make a little kind of stop here to say it's really interesting giving this talk today. And I did, like, I just, what keeps coming to me, like from the beginning, and I haven't been saying it, but I have to say it, is that at 10 o'clock this morning, or at 11, I think, I said to Nathan, this is going to be a really good talk. And it's really interesting to see in 5 hours how things can shift, you know. And when I was sitting here just before, I was thinking, I don't know. So I'm not saying this to get a sympathy vote. It just feels really important to kind of really be honest with that and just seeing that, you know, this is kind of what I'm talking about. Not closing off, not because at 11 o'clock it felt this is really good, this is the right thing, this is what I want to say, this is what people could benefit from hearing. It's not necessarily the fact right now. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. So being open to that also. Not shutting off and saying, okay, I'm going to give this talk the way I wrote it because that's what I thought and I've prepared and that's... But being true, what is going on right now? What is real right now? And sometimes just voicing that, just expressing that, releases something inside because that tension that was there and the holding is gone. So listening to that inner voice sometimes, which is saying, telling us to do things which aren't completely rational, like saying what I just said. But kind of being true to that, listening to that, which is also what the Buddha did. He listened to that voice, even though all the outer voices were saying, you're a prince, you're about to be a king, you're a father, you're a husband, you have these responsibilities. Don't look. Don't search. Don't rock the boat. And yet he listened, and he followed that curiosity, that interest that he had. And he went out to explore. And another thing that I really like about this story is that he took his time. So many times we also have this sense of curiosity or interest, and we feel, okay, you know, I need to figure this out, I need to make a decision, I need to make a choice. I need to find the path and walk it, you know. Pressure, pressure, pressure. And he just took his time. He went out one time and he came back and he digested. And he went out again and he came back and he digested. He didn't rush. He didn't go around the palace shouting to everyone, you know what I've discovered? Old age exists. Open your eyes, or whatever it is. He just let himself digest, let himself take it in. And eventually he went on a fourth trip. And this time what he saw was a wandering monk. So, you know, again he asked his charioteer, what's that? What's that weird looking guy in funny robes and... what's he doing? And his charioteer said, well, this is somebody who's dedicated his life to discovering truth, to freeing himself from the prison palace, to doing something different, to finding out what is at the root of this self-created palace that we live in, so that the walls can dissolve. And after this encounter, he decided to do the same. So this opened up the possibility of actually following that interest, that curiosity, the whole way. And I'm always amazed at that confidence that he had in himself, that he could do it. You know, to go out to transform his life completely from the life of a prince to the life of someone who lives without fixed shelter, without fixed food, without fixed anything. Just dedicating himself to this search. And again, this story, this divine messenger's story, is what I kind of call it in my head, is really relevant to us, to all of us. Because they're here in our lives all the time, giving the same message that the Buddha heard, which is really look at life. Look at life. Let's discover what's at the root of unhappiness and how to change that. And I also feel that part of why they're divine is because they're so mundane, because they're there in everything all the time. If we really look. If we really look. And as we practice, as we turn to look at our experience, to look at ourselves, to look at the way we live, the way we move in life, then we meet them more and more honestly. Then we see the ways in which we stay in the palace, in which we actually continue to create the palace walls for ourselves. We see what we're ignoring, what needs our attention. And this can be often in direct relation to the same divine messengers that the Buddha encountered: aging, sickness, and death. I remember a couple of years ago when I started getting white hairs, and it was amazing what a distressing experience that was. And it still is, you know, I still catch myself sometimes in front of the mirror looking and just kind of thinking, ah, oh, there's so many more. And sometimes even kind of pulling one out without kind of being fully aware in that moment of what I'm doing. And it's every time it's incredible to see just how strong that conditioning is of white hairs bad. I don't want to see this. I don't want other people to see this. And when I look into that, you know, it's clearly not just about the hair turning white. It's also about what that means, about the progress of my life. So there's so many opportunities for this, the wrinkles. I mean, it's great also, I feel like getting older is great in that way, because when I was younger, I didn't have all these things to kind of keep me busy. But the wrinkles, you know, who keep growing despite using, you know, very good organic products, still more. Or I remember a good friend of mine who is a Western woman living in India, and I guess she's in her late 40s now, and she was telling me about the moment when young Indian men stopped treating her as a sexual object and started calling her auntie and treating her with a lot of respect, and how despite years of acute suffering, which I think most women in this room can probably relate to, of just walking around and being seen as a sexual object against your will, this was worse. Yeah? Because it's like, oh no, you know, now they're seeing me as an old woman. And so it's just all these opportunities that we have to see and to laugh. I mean, laughing at ourselves is great when it's in this kind of kind way. To say, okay, here's something that I'm not looking at, and which is really hard to look at. It's not easy. Yeah? It's very hard to look at and to see. Or one of my favorite teachers, Stephen Levine, he says the best teachings that we get is when we have the flu. When our body doesn't function in the way we're used to. And how that feels and how we react, that teaches us so much about ourselves. So these are all messengers. These are all opportunities that life is constantly offering us. And if we can look at them that way. And of course, the divine messengers aren't limited to just these themes of aging, sickness, and death. They come up all the time. Experiences, messages, things that touch us, that affect us. which are calling our attention, which are saying, look, look at this. Look at this. This is something to see. This is something to be interested in. And whenever we're in that kind of experience and we can remember that that's not the whole picture, that there's more. And so it can be anything. It can be someone in front of you at the lunch queue. No, I have a better example. Something in front of you at the someone in front of you at the breakfast queue taking what you're sure is more than their fair share of papaya. Or more than 2 spoons of raisins, even though the sign clearly says 2 spoons. Yeah? Just something like that. And what that triggers. And so it triggers some sense of whatever, righteousness or anger. And that is an opportunity to look. To say, okay, there's the anger, there's the righteousness. Possibly I'm right and that person is a really bad, bad, bad person. It could be. But this is also an opportunity to kind of see what's happening in me. Yeah, what is happening in me? And how can I address that? Can I open up to be bigger than the anger or the righteousness or the idea of what is the right or wrong thing? Because then it transforms our lives. We're not just caught up in this small exchange between myself, the ideas, and this other person who I can't even speak to because we're in silence. And I can see a bigger picture. Okay, what about this anger? Is this something that I want to live with? Even if it's really justified and that person is really bad. But what is it doing to me in me? So this is kind of the examples I'm talking about. And I remember a retreat I did some years ago where, you know, we may consider this a basic environment, but the meditation hall in that case was just a dirt floor. And someone thought, dirt is dirty. So let's cover it with a very, very large sheet of thick plastic, which made it cleaner, but also made it very, very noisy. So I like meditating in the evenings. And I, every night, every evening, when the last bell went, and people would, this was also an outdoor hall, so you had to collect all your stuff and take it back to your room. You couldn't leave it there overnight. So the bell would ring for the last sitting, and I would be lying there, really enjoying the quietness in my space. And then people would get up and roll their mattresses and take their bags and all of this on a thick plastic sheet. You can imagine how much noise there was. So this was a very unpleasant experience for me, and I would feel like I wish that person did it this way, and I wish whoever had come up with the idea of putting this plastic sheet on this ground was more intelligent. I wish it was last year before the plastic sheet, whatever. You know, you can imagine all these thoughts and emotions going on. And then one evening, I decided I was just gonna be with what was happening. So someone would get up and roll their things and there'd be this rustling noise. And I would feel the irritation coming up. And so without suppressing the irritation, the anger, the annoyance at the sound, at the annoying sound, but also without getting hooked into it and starting to put it on the person or that person or whatever, I was just with the experience of annoyance. And from the experience of annoyance, the experience of the sound. And it felt like just being with that, it became like a bubble that would float up into the air, and at some moment would just pop, the way, you know, a soap bubble does when we're kids. It would just rise up and disappear. Again and again and again. Every time someone moved, every time someone rustled. And so from a very unpleasant experience, it became an experience of transformation. And I was actually found myself then really looking forward to this part of the day when this was happening, because I would follow the irritation and then not get caught up, and then it would disappear and there'd be a sense of ease that came after. So another way, another image for this is came for me recently when I was on the beach, and I was noticing that, well, I know this from about me for a long time, I don't like waves so much. I much prefer the sea to be very quiet. And so on the days when it wasn't quiet and I would still go in to the sea, and there'd be some relatively big waves coming, I was noticing that my and other people's as well, it wasn't just me, you see a big wave coming, the instinct is to run out. Yeah? To run away from. Whereas what actually is the most helpful is to run towards or to jump in to the wave. Has anyone had that experience? Yeah. And it's really amazing, this shift. Instead of something is coming at us, which we don't want. It's not what I would choose. You know, I'd rather that the sea was calm. But there's waves and I want to be in the sea. So the wave is coming. And my habitual tendency, my palace constructing mechanism, we can say, is to turn around and run away in the other direction. And that's pretty guaranteed that I'm going to get gotten. I'm going to get gotten by the wave. But if I go not with that habitual tendency, but the other way, and I turn towards the waves and I go into the wave, then I catch the wave before it washes over me, and I can actually jump up, and it's even fun. So that's kind of the experience I'm talking about here. But doing that not just with waves, but also with the waves of our lives, not just with physical waves. And I feel that in a way, this is the Buddha's message. Stop trying to run away from the waves. That's what he was saying to us. Stop trying to run away from the waves. Instead of using my energy to run away from the waves, can I use my energy to run into the waves so that I can actually be free in a way from this, so that I can understand life? So instead of running away from what I don't want or what I don't want to see, can I turn towards that so that I can understand and transform life for myself and others? And of course, this is easier said than done. So also to keep that in mind, that kind of gentleness and kindness to ourselves, if this sounds like a good idea. Not expecting that, okay, now I'm going to walk out of this hole and this is what I'm going to do for every moment. But at the same time, feeling that, if it touches you, feeling that intention and the wish to cultivate that, to nourish that. And it's a kind of radical transformation of our basic attitude. Instead of seeing waves as problems, seeing them as opportunities. Making what is challenging or difficult not something to run away from, but something to learn from, to grow from. And this can go really, really deep, and it has kind of more and more layers in our experience. I find I'm talking quite a lot about myself. So if myself is boring, well, I apologize. But there's just one more kind of recent insight that I wanted to share, which connects to this. A couple of months ago, I was lying in bed in the morning feeling guilty that I wasn't getting up to do my yoga practice. And that's been a pretty constant experience in my life for the last couple of years. After many years of having no problem to get up and doing to do yoga, suddenly that changed. And so at times when I theoretically have the time, I often find myself not doing the yoga, but lying in bed feeling guilty that I'm not doing yoga. And, you know, feeling the shame, the judgment, the self-criticism. You're so lazy. If people knew that. All that kind of story. And there was a moment when something just slightly shifted, and I dropped from that narrative of the guilt, the shame, the feeling bad, to actually feeling the place that wanted to get up and do yoga. So not that layer of negativity above, but, and I've been actually talking about this in some one-to-ones today, feeling that which is underneath, which is deeper down than that, which is the longing to do what is useful, what is nourishing, what is supportive. And we can see that in ourselves so much of the time. When we get stuck in what we're not doing, or what we're not doing well, and we actually, that is a doorway into the place that does want to do, that does want to offer, that does want to support, that does want to be compassionate, whatever it is, that does want to be at peace, that wants to offer to others, that doesn't want to be angry, whatever it is. And again, these patterns that can cause us so much suffering are also the divine messengers. If we just have enough perspective, and sometimes it feels like grace when that happens, to suddenly see a bit more. And we can also gently train ourselves in that way. When we see that pattern, actually it happened again this morning, lying in bed thinking, I'm not at the morning sitting. I can get up and do yoga. And then saying, okay, that worked. So let's connect to the intention, the part that wants to do a yoga practice. And so again, shifting, instead of using my energy to make myself feel bad about myself, using that energy to actually nourish and strengthen that part that wants to benefit, that wants to help, that wants to nourish. So opening up to the beauty of our aspirations. And as we open, we give them light and they can grow. That part of me that doesn't want to cause pain to myself or others, whatever it is. And not doing that just as a way of making myself feel good, and not doing that through repressing the so-called negative or bad or unhelpful, but just by opening and giving space. Because within us, is the same nature as within the Buddha. Within us is that wish to live with compassion, to live with care and with wisdom and clarity. And so it's also helpful to remember that it's not every time that we see something in ourselves, it doesn't mean that always, as we see, transformation will happen. Sometimes this shift is so subtle that we can't actually see it at that moment. But every clear seeing, every turning towards the waves, every time we do that, we're strengthening a momentum. We're changing our habitual way of running away. Every time we do that, we're kind of weakening the foundations of the palace walls and opening. And this same attitude works internally with ourselves and also externally with each other. It's the same attitude. Turning towards the divine messengers that are coming internally and externally. What comes from others when someone makes me angry. When someone makes me angry. Beautiful, the language in itself has the message. Whenever we are faced with difficulties or challenges, internal or external. And I just want to end with a short story which hopefully will illustrate this. And this is a story about a few friends of mine. And one friend discovered that she had cancer, and it was quite, by the time it was discovered, she needed treatment very, very quickly. And it so happens that she's a Palestinian woman, and so for good quality treatment, she needed to come into Israel. And she has a lot of Israeli friends, so these friends helped to get the permit. It's a Palestinian woman, she needed a special permit to come into Israel to get treatment. And her family got the financial aid from the Palestinian Authority. And this all happened very, very quickly, just within a few days from the diagnosis. So the permit, which you usually have to go and pick up and have the paper permit to when you come to the checkpoint to cross over into Israel, there wasn't time for that. It was only ready the night before she had to be hospitalized. And so the people in the Israeli army said, don't worry, it's in the system, it's all computerized. When you get to the checkpoint, the soldiers there will be able to find it on their computers and they'll let you through. And so she arrived at the Palestinian side of the checkpoint, and her friends, my friends, arrived on the Israeli side of the checkpoint. They can't, Palestinians and Israelis cannot cross the same checkpoint. So two sides of the checkpoint. And they were waiting on the Israeli side for her to get through. And she was on the Palestinian side trying to get through. And the soldiers at the checkpoint were saying, sorry, we can't find your permit. It's not here. And so they waited for about 5 hours, making phone calls, you know, to all the other people that had helped, trying to find out what was going on, where was this mysterious permit and how to get there. And our friend Naima, she gave up. She said, I'm going back home, you know. Forget about this, I'm just going to go home. And the Israeli friend said, wait, just wait. And they decided that they would just walk into the checkpoint, which they're not supposed or allowed to do. Walk into the checkpoint in the hope that by doing that, someone would come up to them to say, you know, you're not allowed to do this. And then they could say, ah, you know, we're having this problem. Could you help? That was the best plan that they could come up with to try and deal with this situation. And so that's what they did. They just wandered in to the checkpoint, and a soldier came up and said, what are you doing here? You're not supposed to be here. And they said, our friend is just there. We can see her. And she's being operated on tomorrow, and she needs to. And the permit is somewhere in the system. You know, can you help us find it? And that person then helped them find the permit. And eventually the permit was found. And she could come through, and she was operated on the next day. And so the reason, the example I'm giving here is to encourage all of us to not be limited by anyone's palace walls, whatever they are. Even if it's somebody else, even if it's whether it's an individual or a nation state, doesn't matter. Or society as a whole. Not to be limited. To stay steady. To stay open. To try something crazy sometimes. So that the basic goodness which underlies our own hearts and the hearts of everybody can come through. If we don't see the other as our enemy, then we allow them to be a divine messenger. If we don't limit ourselves by someone else's ignorance, then we allow them to not be limited also. It works together. So cultivating steadiness and the ability to see the waves and not run away, that's the first step. And when needed, to walk towards, to jump in, to take chances, to let the palace walls dissolve or stay behind as we walk out into the world. And make contact with the goodness in ourselves and in each other. So let's have a few silent moments to end. May our hearts open and receive the divine messages. In whatever happens in us and around us. May we all leave our palace walls and walk together gently on the earth. Thank you for your listening.